Hello, everyone. This is Shane, and welcome to the Naked Gospel. This conversation is again with Sathya. Sathya and I wanted to process together things we wish we had known about marriage before getting married. Both Sathya and his wife, and me and Kaylee, went through premarital counseling, and yet there were so many things that we just didn't know about marriage, and we wish we had gotten a heads up, just certain aspects and paradigms of marriage that we were just completely blind to. And so Sathya and I want to spend some time processing that together in this upcoming conversation. Somehow we start out this conversation talking about finances and politics, but don't worry, we very quickly move past that and get into processing marriage together. For those of you who are listening and are married, would love to hear how you resonate with some of the things that we process and what you might add to it. For those of you who are not married, would love to hear your feedback as you listen and process some of this conversation. So would love to hear from y'all. And in the meantime, please enjoy this conversation with Sathya Sam. Hello and welcome to The Naked Gospel, where we have conversations about sex, singleness, marriage, pornography, and everything in between. We bring on cultural thinkers, parents, important folk, and normal folk alike. I am your host, Shane O'Neill. All of these episodes are available on every major podcast platform. Whether you're listening or watching, do subscribe and continue to track with us. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy the episode.
All right. Well, always a privilege to sit down with Shane. Nice to see you again, man.
For sure, dude. You're like a dad and stuff.
I'm a dad and stuff. Can't forget the stuff. But yeah, I am a dad. Crazy, man. Judah is 3.5 months old. And I was just telling you before we hit record, he was hospitalized with pneumonia when we got to Jamaica. And those are some of the worst days of my life, man. You don't even realize how much you care about these little nuggets until... Yeah. Unwell or that kind of thing. So yeah. But it's been amazing. Honestly, aside from the hospitalization, he's been a really easy baby. So we kind of lucked out. But how about you, man? You picked up some extra curriculars, you got some extra studies going on, and it's all the other things in the fold. How's that going?
Yes. Yeah, I'm working towards getting my degree and license for therapy, for counseling. And that's going well. Getting challenged in all sorts of ways.
How so?
Goodness. Like my perspective. So maybe, for instance, I have like an allergy towards authority, which is so darn millennial. but maybe becoming more aware, more alert to that. Another thing is my relationship and my perspective towards like even information or knowledge.
Yeah.
Sorry, my wife is I don't know what she's doing. But I'm not supposed to. Towards knowledge. Yeah. So like knowledge as something that I acquire and something that's static, as opposed to something that's maybe like organic and relational, something that grows alongside me. And so like I have a really, I guess one of the core virtues with knowledge is competency. And if I am not competent at something, then I have a great deal of fear towards doing it or trying it, which really doesn't allow for any sort of growth or development. So those sorts of things have come to light, and that's been very humbling and helpful.
It's really interesting because I think I know a lot of people. Honestly, I feel like I'm like the least educated in most of the circles I run in. Like the people I went to university with are all PhDs, doctors, dentists, you know, some of my best friends, they're lawyers on Wall Street and all that kind of stuff. But it's interesting because a lot of them have shared a similar experience when they get into, you know, graduate studies, not undergrad. I feel like all educational experiences up to undergrad kind of are the cause of those feelings, right? Because if you get, like, you either learn something's right or wrong, either you get it right, you get it wrong.
Yes.
You know, you always kind of get reprimanded, or there's consequences if you think outside of the box, or you don't show your work, or you kind of figure out your own way. Like, you're sort of like conditioned to follow the path and to do it perfectly. And then you get into graduate work, and suddenly you have to be much more creative, think outside the box, be a lot more critical in your thinking. Not that those things don't exist previously, but I think they're celebrated a lot more at that level. And it's really interesting because, yeah, you're just reprogramming your brain altogether, aren't you?
I mean, school is literally the script for school is you buy information, right?
Right.
And like when
Yeah.
you come out, you have certain degrees. Like I am a master of this information, right?
Right. Yeah.
Excuse me, a doctor of it. And so yes, like mastery, competency, possession, like these are all like kind of values and virtues around our paradigms for information and knowledge, as opposed to something relational, something that
Yeah.
you can grow in, something that you can be bad at, something that's experiential, as opposed to like some, again, knowledge acquisition as though it's a disposable resource.
Right. So where does the resistance against authority come into play in all this?
My first grade teacher, she was just really quite mean to me. I had like undiagnosed learning disabilities.
Oh,
And
wow.
I don't know. I mean, I was like at a private prep school, and she seemed to like maybe make it her mission to like try and, I don't know, like get those out of me. I'm not sure. But like every day she'd have me like go to the board and diagram sentences for grammar, and I just couldn't do it, and my hand would be shaking and I'd stammer, and this would just happen for like a year.
Oh.
So just I think that that was the first time I suppose I saw an authority that was greater than my parents' authority. And so
Yeah.
like re relational authority became subservient to like this formal systemic authority.
Yeah.
I just didn't ever want to be in that position again,
Right.
So I mean that's I so much of that is unknown. I'm just a little guy, just a first grader.
Yeah.
But just scared. So like even some of my body's reactions towards school, towards authority, those sorts of things. My body remembers the story, even if my head doesn't. But like, yeah, I would say like the last few months, you're like, oh, like, yeah. 'Cause that's been even my relationship with God. I really love his relational authority. His companionship is like the
Yeah.
gospel to me. But when it comes to like providence, I have like really hard, difficult issues with it.
Huh.
I can get on the level with sovereignty, but when it comes to like providence, the idea that God is in charge of or orchestrates everything, I have a difficult time. So it's all of
Yeah.
it's just fascinating and interesting. Thank you
Yeah.
for asking.
No, it's an interesting point you brought up, because I was reading Romans 13 this morning, and Romans 13 is all about submission to governmental authorities, and it's just, I think it's become a very interesting conversation in this day and age, where, like, I'm based in Canada, I'm in Jamaica right now, but based in Canada, where, the government's been really strong on certain aspects that, I am fundamentally against, and that tension, of like, we're supposed to honor our authorities, like, that's scriptural. And then where's the line where it's like, you're honoring authority, but maybe you're compromising, your own convictions that are scripture based and whatever. So just a conversation we've been having, and my wife's family that lives here in Jamaica has kind of fled Canada, quote unquote. Not quite like that, but they're very glad that they don't live in Canada. And Jamaica in general, the culture here is very anti-establishment. Like a great example would be Canada's vaccination rate was about 81, 82% across the nation. Jamaica's was 18%. There's just such a distrust because there's so much corruption here. And so, the whole Romans 13, living out the respect for authority, just looks so different here than it does in Canada, and obviously in America as well. I know most people listening are American. So I just thought it was interesting you brought the authority thing, because I've been thinking about that day and night for the last couple of days, and was literally reading about it in Romans 13 this morning.
There's that passage in Timothy where Paul is talking to Timothy and he is talking about worshiping God, lifting up holy hands, live peaceable lives, quiet, peaceable lives, and praying for those who are in authority so that you might live quiet quiet, peaceable lives. I liked that because it's an action and then a why. He tells you why. It's like so that you can live peaceable lives. So you can live like just love your neighbor in simple ways, and you have the freedom to do that. You have the freedom to worship God. And I fail at that point. I want the effect without excuse me. Excuse me. Engaging the cause of I don't often I don't know. I don't pray. I don't pray, for like my governor, like by name very often. I don't pray for my president by name very often. State senators, those sorts of things. I think that that's always a challenge to me, where it's like, hey, like, are you humanizing the people, right, who are making these laws, like setting these bills in motion? Or are you dehumanizing them and feeling like it's just a spiritual warfare where you're combating legislation, And so I often come back to that, and that's been a helpful refrain.
That's good perspective. Yeah, there's the there it's verse 7 in Romans 13, and it's this is New King James Version, but it's like that basically like the summation, of all these like pretty strong statements about respecting authority and don't resist the ordinances of God, and God places these people in their place of authority for a reason and all that. But basically at the end, Paul just writes, render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Like it's kind of that idea of like, yeah, that's sort of where it all resolves. It's like if they are in that position, they get it anyway. But there is an additional layer to it. And I think this is actually a good segue into what we wanted to discuss today, which was kind of the whole concept of marriage, things we wished we knew before we were married. And you made a delineation between systemic authority or positional authority versus relational authority. And I can't think of a better exemplification of that than marriage. And I guess maybe as a starting point, just to give some context, because we're still relatively young in marriage, and so I don't think we're not the experts, we're not the people in our 60s who have decades of experience and have raised kids together and all that. Like you and I are just starting out, and so we're doing our best to offer what we know so far, just to contextualize it. But I got married September 2019, so it's been 4.5 years for Shaloma and I, and like we were talking about, we just had our first. So that's kind of that's where we've been at. Well, we can get into some of the stuff that we've gone through in our marriage and all that, but how about you, man? How long have you and your wife been married?
3 years.
Three. Okay.
We got married late, during COVID. So late in life for me, at least. I was 30. I'm
Okay.
33. And so we got 3 years, and most of that has been on the road. 'Cause 5 months into marriage, we decided, Kaylee's a nurse, she's an ER nurse, decided to go after debt. And so we've been doing the travel nurse stuff since then. We like moved to Ohio, and we moved to Maryland, in Virginia, and Washington. We're gonna go to Washington State in a few months.
Wow.
Yeah, so all over the place. It's been a heck of a ride, and I'm not sure if I would advise it for anyone else. Kaylee and I are actually reflecting on that yesterday. We're stacking wood outside and reflecting on like we know the Lord led us into this, but would we ever advise? Like, what is like looking back? Could we, without conviction, like just using wisdom, be like, hey, like if somebody were in our situation, be like, hey, like it's a good idea. You should do that. And it was interesting to say, be like, no, like we reasoned, worked through it, dialogued through it, and just like, no, like we actually wouldn't be able to say that. And we could play that out more, but I like what we're doing here because we're not saying this is what we're doing well. We're saying looking back, right? This is what you and I, Cynthia, wish we had known, which is helpful. And I feel like it's a safer sort of reflection.
You mentioned a couple of things there that are pretty interesting. So you guys are like you guys made a decision 5 months in to really go after debt. How did that happen?
Kaylee was working night shift. Excuse me. I was just working during the day at Proven Ministries and with the Naked Gospel podcast. Our marriage Kaylee, so the money, the debt was just a really, really big deal.
Yeah.
It's
For
a lot
you
of
or for
money.
Kaylee or for both?
We both came in with debt. I came in with more debt. I had a graduate degree, so I came in with more debt.
Right.
And Kaylee was just feeling like regular anxiety about it, like every single day, every single day.
Yeah.
Whereas
Yeah.
for me, it's like, yeah, like if it takes us 20 years, but we're happy, then that's fine. She's like, well, how could we be happy with this sort of debt? You know, like all the things we can't do. And I'm like, okay, like you bring some good points to the table. And the night shift was really crushing her and killing her. So when it came to actually
Okay.
working for a hospital, like those were the only shifts that were available. I have all sorts of ish when it comes to the medical field, healthcare professionals, and the system there. But that's not the topic of this conversation. Anyway, so she's not doing so hot. We're not doing so hot. And we're like, okay, let's aggressively go after debt because this is an option. And we sit down with community members. We sit down with older brothers and older sisters, pastor, that sort of thing, and say, hey, like over the next month, 2 months, can you process and pray and be in dialogue with us about this? So like pull together like a discerning family and went forward from there.
Wow, very cool. And you've picked up a new graduate degree since then. So obviously you guys have been able to get ahead enough that you felt confident to take on some more debt, or are you able to basically not incur debt? Like how's that journey been?
Yeah, this this is such a it's a fun podcast episode.
I know we're getting to the weeds, man. We didn't
Yes,
plan
no,
any of
you're
this.
doing great. I like it. Fun question. Thank you for asking. Kaylee and I work and we live simple enough. So basically when it comes to like, you know, there's a floor and a ceiling when it comes to finances, and like your floor is basically going to be, you know, living, travel, and food, right? So
Yeah.
groceries, gas, and rent or mortgage. We've been able to rent out space so that we don't pay anything for housing.
Sweet.
And then we got a Prius, which gets like 70 miles to the gallon. So like we pay very little
Okay.
on gas. And then when it comes to food, I just like pick up like side jobs that end up covering food throughout the week. So our floor is
Wow.
really, really stable, and then we are able to pay out of pocket. She's finishing up like her medical degree with a nurse practitioner with a focus in midwifery,
Okay. Yeah.
and I'm doing the counseling therapy program. And yeah, so we are not taking on more debt. We are
Wow.
living really, really lean, but we're paying for both the degrees out of pocket.
Man, that's so impressive. We have similar stories there. Like Shaloma and I had some pretty hard conversations about money when we were engaged. Well, we had hard conversations about everything because crap just hit the fan so badly when we were engaged. And it's almost laughable. I don't think she would mind me sharing this story, but Shaloma had started a degree, and then due to some mental health reasons and some family reasons, she quit early, about a year and a half in. But she owed a bit of a loan, and she was studying locally, so she didn't have to pay for like residency and all that. But she owed $3,000, and especially like three. Not to say that $3,000 is a small amount of money, but in the conversation around student loans, you know, that's a drop in the bucket. But she felt so much shame about it, and we had all these conversations, and I was basically like, well, I think we need to just pool our resources together and pay this off. And she was like, no, this is not your debt. You know, like I could never let you do that, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it was like, no, I think you need to let me do that. And then she got sick and she couldn't work. And it was like, okay, we really need to go after this together. And it forced us to kind of unify. But then, you know, when we got married, like I was working as an executive assistant. I kind of took a job that I was overqualified for to be part of the organization that I really believed in. And then Shaloma was sick, and so I was thinking at least when we get married we'll have dual incomes, but we didn't even have that, and so we lived super lean those first couple of years, and we were so happy, you know, and that was the cool thing for us to discover in that season was like, man, you know, everyone tells you once you get married then you have to get this and you have to get that, and we had so little, and I what I mean I shouldn't say we were happy, it was a really hard season. But I guess we were content. There was a very small part of me that wished we had more. That was kind of the provider in me. But generally speaking, day to day, it was like, man, this is amazing. Like, God's providing for us and our bills are getting paid and it's not a big deal. And we basically made an agreement in that season. We said, you know what, if we ever come into more money, you know, my job changes or whatever, which has been the case, you know, now I have a business that's doing well. But we both agreed, like, we are not going to pursue those frivolous things for a while. Like, we're going to really, we just like the simple life, you know, and there's things that we can do. If there's some surplus, we'll invest, we'll build a runway, we'll, you know, start to build some generational wealth maybe. But it's been really, really good for us. But that finance thing is big, and it's cool that you and Kaylee were on the same page. Because I think the initial parts of that conversation you said were like, one person's really stressed about debt, need to pay it off, need to pay it off, and the other one's like, you know what, it's debt, it's fine, what's the big deal? I think often that's where the conversations end, and it's like, well, we have to agree to disagree, and this poor person's miserable, and the other person doesn't care, and whatever. So it's cool that you guys were able to like come to a middle ground. I think you especially to be sensible enough to say, even though I'm actually relatively comfortable, yeah, you know what, I'd be willing to tackle this, and I can see some advantages to it. That's pretty cool.
It is cool. Thanks for playing that, Sathya. Yeah, we went to Ohio, and we went there in like January or February. So it was the dead of winter in Ohio, snow. We have one vehicle. Kaylee's working 12-hour shifts, so I'm stuck in this very rural place by myself. My depression is spiking and I'm a mess. We were in a situation there where it was like if we didn't find each other, we wouldn't make it. You know, it was like, hey, like if I don't see you, we're effed. And if you don't see me, we're effed, you know. That was really vital, and it was really scary. And that's maybe one of the reasons I wouldn't advise it for other people, because like we didn't have any other resources, any community around us. It was like, hey, this is make or break. Can we see one another? You know? And we did, and that was really significant. I think one of the things that I don't often see in the marital scripts around me, well, around me and Kaylee, because this is a conversation that we've had, an ethos we've built into our marriage. Not a lot of marriages build together. So typically, like one has a career, the other has a career, or one stays at home and one leaves the home, and they come back. Maybe they make dinner together. They end up making a kid, you know. But usually that ends up being like a really strenuous time because they've never really made anything together before. And then all of a sudden, like, what are our shared values? How are we going to raise this? Like, hey, I don't like how you did that. Because making something together is really difficult, right? Because there's a lot of trust is required and a lot of mutual submission is required. And so learning how to build, how to have a shared vision, and to move towards that together and say, hey, you talk this way and I talk this way. Our language styles are different. Can we have to find a shared language in this? And I have to learn how to trust you. Like, what sort of wisdom are you bringing? What sort of wisdom? And like, are we allowed to fail together? Is that okay? Are we more important than the outcome? You know, and working through that. So Kaylee and I started to discover that aspect of marriage, which wasn't necessarily, again, an image of marriage or a vision of marriage that we had inherited. It's something that my parents have really, so it's something that they inhabited really early on in their marriage when they were in the Philippines. They were doing church planting, but when they came back to America, it's so, you know, ministry is so male dominated that, you know, dad was being sent different places to speak. And yeah. So it was later on, like once I was in maybe my early 20s, that my dad would only, like, he took a position. He's like, hey, I will only come on if there's a budget for Sterling to always travel with me. Like, I don't ever travel without her, you know, because she's my partner. Yeah. And so that's been like the criteria. And they don't even work for any organizations. They just do their own thing now because it's like, yeah, it's us, you know, like, and organization came would come maybe like complicate their marriage more than actually add to it. So I'm really proud of them. But there was a stretch of time where like dad, you know, dad was the superhero doing things for Jesus. Mom was at home. And it's been a joy to see them recalibrate and for Kaylee and I to inherit that vision as well.
That's cool. Yeah, my parents have actually had a similar trajectory. Like dad was the pastor and mom kind of supported him quietly in the prayer closet kind of thing, but they've done a lot more together the last 5 to 10 years, and it's been really good for them. It's interesting what you said though about just building together. We had a guy on the podcast maybe about a month ago. His name is Adam Lane Smith, so he's like an attachment specialist, and he has a, like a neurobiological slant to the conversation on attachment, which I really appreciated. And he talked about how, you know, a lot of the conversations around attachment today are oxytocin bonding, which is building an emotional connection. And, you know, guys historically are not very good at this. And this is an area we need to naturally just, or not unnaturally rather, develop in, you know, whereas for women, it comes more naturally and whatever. But he said that's sort of like one element of attachment. And another really major component is what they call vasopressin bonding. And men are more inclined to vasopressin bond, which is bonding by doing things, which is why if you and I were hanging out in person, we'd probably be at least, you know, we'd be around a campfire drinking a beer together. Or, you know, like when I hang out with my guy friends, we're playing video games, you're doing something together.
Go to the
And he said
gym.
that, yeah, you go to the gym, whatever. And that kind of bonding in a relationship is actually really necessary for a guy to feel like he's attached to his wife and he's building a connection. And as they've studied couples over longer periods of time, the key to longevity in successful marriages is not oxytocin bonding. That's obviously important, but vasopressin bonding was a much greater predictor of the success of a marriage long term, which is just really, really interesting because I think that building together thing is something like it really caused me to look inside and be like, man, what are Shaloma and I building together? You know, and raising a family definitely is that, but I'm also of the opinion that I don't want our marriage to center around our family building. Like, obviously we can't avoid it. You know, it's something we want, but I want us to have stuff outside of that. And so we had a really cool season where, like, you know, I worked on a book and she helped me a little bit with it. She worked on an album and I got to kind of be the brains behind the operation, so to speak. Really stressful seasons, and we probably didn't have to do it all in the same year, but really rewarding, you know. And it that I hadn't factored that in. Like, to be honest, I've worked a lot more on the oxytocin emotional kind of bonding the last couple of years because I just felt like that was such a deficiency in my own relationship, and something I wanted to have in the marriage. But it was really encouraging for me to just be reminded by this guy, Adam Smith, just that, like, actually a guy's natural bend to, you know, do things and to bond by doing things is actually really healthy, not just for him. It's actually really good for a marriage.
Cynthia, I want so a big I really love all of that. And I'm totally on the level with you. And one of the things that no one explicitly taught me or told me before getting married is that I need to w take care of myself in a way that I never have before. That if I want to love my wife in healthy ways, then I need to make sure I'm really healthy and that they'll be commensurate with one another. If I want to be physically present to her, then I need to be physically taking care of myself. If I want to be emotionally present to her, then I need to make sure that I'm emotionally being present to myself and developing practices that are cultivating health in those areas, spiritually, whatever. I was given a model of masculinity, of husbandhood, that was more doormat, was like you burn yourself out, you break your body for your wife, you know, like you die like Christ died for the church, you know. And it's like, well, like waited 30 years. Like he cultivated himself for 30 years for 3 years, you know. It's like he had a lot to give. Like he, and even then, like he's still like getting away in the mornings. You know, and they're looking
Still
everywhere for him
recharging.
because presumably there's work to be done, and he's over there tending to himself. You know, he's letting the father tend to him, and then they still come to him, and he's like, "Hey, like people are looking for you," and he's like, "Let's actually move on. Like we're gonna move on." You know, there are other people elsewhere, and we need to go for a walk. So yeah, that's something that I didn't, and that's something I had to learn. Was like, oh my gosh, like I'm not allowed to just break myself for her. Like I actually have to strive to be whole and healthy for her. Can you speak to that and what your experience has been with that?
Oh, it's It's such a good point. I know for me, so I'm definitely a recovering people pleaser, and that's a lot to do with my upbringing. And not that my parents like beat me into a people pleaser, but it's sort of Indian culture. Like you're just very subservient, respectful of authorities, and kind of what you want, it matters, but it doesn't matter that much. And I've worked really hard, and honestly, I'm very grateful for my parents who have worked on themselves quite a bit as well over the years, if I could put it that way. And that dynamic changed, but I felt bad at times in marriage where it's like, man, I'm doing this great thing, but I should be spending time with my wife, or I should be doing the dishes. But I know that doing this great thing for me, sometimes it's just as simple as going for a walk. Like it's nothing fancy, but those things allow me to come back and be more present, like you're saying, be more connected, be more available. And I will say that everything you've just articulated goes on steroids when you become a father, because especially like in our current dynamic, I leave the house in the morning, I go to my office, I work a normal day, and then I'm home. So I'm very aware that my wife is doing all the work at home, raising Judah, while I'm at work. And the one day, my wife, this was like, I don't know, this was maybe 6 weeks in, and I had only been going back to work for a couple of weeks at that time. And she was like, oh, how was your day today? And I was like, oh, it was really good. And had this meeting and talked with this person. I was like, I'm really sore though. Like I had a pretty intense workout. And she was like, you're working out? And I was like, well, yeah, like I work out at lunch. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh my gosh, this poor woman, like, she doesn't have a spare minute to work out. Like, I probably shouldn't have, you know what I mean? Like, you kind of go through all this. And she wasn't like, how dare you work out? Who do you think you are? Like, she wasn't mad. But you could just tell, like, she's like, wow, your experience of being a parent is so different than mine. Like, it really hit her in that moment, and it hit me too. But I've since, like, I have those moments where sometimes I want to coil back a little bit. But I've had to remind myself, actually, I'm working out because it's really good for my well-being. Like that's why I work out. It's good for my mental health. It's good for my body. And if I can get something like that in every day, then I actually am more present to help Shaloma. I'm more able-bodied. I have more energy. Like, and I have to just remind myself of that, because the little things like that are very easy. Like for me, it's easy to be like, yeah, who do I think I am? Like, I don't need to be working out. I should be going home during that time instead and helping Shaloma or whatever. Like I go to those places a lot. So yeah, that's something that I'm learning, the whole like self-care, being a priority. Yeah, learning that one all the time.
Jay Stringer talks about that specifically. He's got multiple kids, but he talks about that in Unwanted of like self-advocacy, as mutuality, not as like hey, like this is what I need to be healthy. So he gives the example of, hey, Saturday, this coming Saturday morning, I'd like to go up to the mountains, which is like an hour away, spend an hour there, come back down. That'll be really good for me. I'll be able to be more present to you and the kids. If I do that, what can I give you that would be good for you? And so like there's like, hey, like can you give this to me? I'm not taking it. Can you give it to me? And if so, what can I give you?
That's
Right.
good.
And so like there is that mutuality of, excuse me, I went running this morning and it's messing with me. So it's like, hey, I need this every day. This is something like this makes me this allows me to be more like a physically capable father to our son. I can wake up easier at night. I can do things, what do you need? What's something that's commensurate? It's, 40 minutes a day where like this would help you. And I think those sorts of conversations are good. A terrifying question that I ask Haley from time to time is something like along the lines of excuse me. Like if they're feeling honored. Like, hey, are you feeling honored? And how can I support and honor you better? Like, is there anything I can do to support and honor you better? Like, are you feeling that though? Because it's like, well, I'm obviously trying to. And more often when somebody says no, then it's like, oh, well, like you feel invalidated. It's like, oh, like, okay, well, then I'm just failing and like, screw it. Or it's like, no, like, how can I redirect my energy and actions in a way that is meaningful to you and not just meaningful to me, because I am doing this for you. So I think those sorts of questions have been safeguards for us. And I really like Jay Stringer's advice. Again, this is marriage has never been easy for me and Kaylee. So none of this is hubris. None of this is said from a pedestal. It's never been easy. It's good. It's really good. But we've never like fallen into like, hey, like, yeah, easy stride. Rhythms are good. You know, like this is, that's never happened.
What's been the greatest challenge that you guys have faced? Like you mentioned, you said it hasn't been easy, but is there a fight that you guys just seem to have over and over again, or what's been like a major challenge that you guys have been facing?
Ooh. Do you have an answer to that question? Well,
I do.
Go first and I'll pull something up.
So basically Shaloma and I have polar opposite coping mechanisms when we are in distress. So our conflict resolution is really hot cold. If one of us is in a really good space, usually they can impart their, you know, presence of mind and whatever else to the other, and we reach a resolution. But if for whatever reason, like especially, you know, rearing a child, we've had some of our worst arguments since having a kid, and generally day to day things have actually been really good. It's just that when there is distress, like it's all of a sudden like a level 11. And the thing that we encounter again and again is when we reach these points where things have escalated, I usually have the presence of mind to at least say, you know what, we're at the tipping point here. If this continues, this is going to be a problem. And I'll just say, hey, I think I'm at like my limit, or I'm pretty close to my limit. When can we resume this conversation, or let's resume this a little bit later, whatever. But for her, that kind of like disconnection or detachment in the middle of conflict is it's a very insecure feeling for her. And she feels like she's being abandoned. She has this kind of fear of like, you know, what if we never resolve this conflict? Like it kind of takes her to all these worst case scenarios. So I was actually shocked the first couple of times we encountered it, because I was pretty impressed with myself just to have the presence of mind to say like, hey, I'm reaching my limit. Let's protect the relationship here. Let's not let this get worse and say things we regret. And I just did not account for the fact that that could be perceived as abandonment and rejection and all these negative things to someone else. And that's something that she and I still haven't figured out. Like we're actually, when we get back to Canada, we're probably going to do some marriage counseling over it, because we just have not been able to solve it on our own. And we've tried all kinds of different things. You know, we've tried the like, let's, you know, like no raising your voices. Let's try to stop things from ever getting there. We've tried the like, hey, if you communicate it this way, I can receive it better. And it all makes sense, you know, when you're not in the conflict and you're not at a level 10. But then once you get to level 10, you can do all the things you said you were going to do. It doesn't always register the same way. So we've reached an impasse there. And the core element of it is that, you know, when I'm in distress, I need space. I like the space. I like being able to process. And when she's in distress, she needs all the attachment and connection in the world. Like she just needs me to be there to reassure her that I love her still. And so those kind of conflicting methods have been, a real point of tension in our relationship for sure.
Thanks for sharing that, dude. Yeah, that plays for sure. Because I can downplay. So Kaylee will like, can be like, maybe like, so her response to, maybe like stress response is to fight, and mine's to flee. Which is helpful, because when we're both unhealthy, the other person can kind of like drag the other person out. Where it's like, okay, like I need to fight, but I'm trying to like hide, you know? And it's like, no, like she can help me, and vice versa. When hers, like she's trying to fight, I can help de-escalate her. But yeah, that means I can be avoidant of things. Okay. So I came into marriage with more debt, right? Kaylee works an ER job. She's in school in a very tough program. She works gnarly long hours in where every task is literally an emergency, right? Like everything. Like her cortisol levels like get jacked up. It's a brainwashing environment. It's 12 hours of it, and there's no windows, you know? It's just artificial light and trauma. It's just crazy. And then like here I am, like at the house, she gets home and I'm like sitting on the couch, like writing a blog article. You know, it's like, hey babe, how's your day? You know? And so I think it's been that where it's like, I can minimize things, whereas she can exacerbate. She can see it heightened and I can minimize it. So when I do try and de-escalate, when I do try and say, hey, like we are emotionally compromised. Like we're not fighting like with one another, we're fighting at one another. Like we are the you're the enemy and I'm the enemy. There's nothing good about this. If I try and say like, hey, can we come back to this? For her natural instinct is to say like, you're being avoidant. Like you're being avoidant. Like it's hard to trust. And a lot of it goes back to like those early relational templates of like, for me, that first grade teacher was a woman, you know, as like domineering, making demands of me. And I could never win, you know, like I could never accomplish, I could never succeed. And so like trauma, an easy definition for trauma is like when we are importing more emotion into a situation than is like called for. It's like, oh, like I'm having like some sort of trauma response. And it's this easy way. It's like kind of like, oh, like I'm reacting beyond the confines of this context, you know? And I can notice that in my relationship with Kaylee. And for Kaylee, like her dad was, you know, a drug addict and was avoidant and I couldn't hold a job, wouldn't work, would kind of mosey around at the house. And she's so awesome because like she's learned to say like just different situations, like I'm in danger of like seeing you like him, you know? And like so like then she'll like actually like call a timeout, like she can distinguish like, oh, like this is a trauma moment, you know, like you're Shane, you're not Danny, you know? And like humanize me and like dignify my person. So working through that, like I think a lot of those situations can be really contentious, really difficult for us because I feel like there's nothing I can do to succeed and to be a good husband. And she feels like she's having to do everything and she has an absentee husband. It's like, oh God, you know.
It makes a lot of sense. It's interesting how so many of these dynamics really revert back to our upbringings, our early childhood experiences, and experiences we've had along the way. Like, they form so many of our responses. It's something I've been actually wanting to ask somebody who is much smarter than me. You might even maybe they even talked about this in your degree that you're pursuing, but it's something I've been thinking about as I raise a kid. Is obviously this, Judah is going to learn how to cope with emotions in the way that he wants to cope, but I can influence that, and I can direct it. And I've been thinking about that, like, how do I teach him to handle himself, handle his emotions in a way that sets him up for the stage of life I'm in right now as a married man, where, when we reach conflict resolution, or when we reach a conflict, like, my responses are not always great, or I'm acting from, trauma of the past. Not that Judah's going to become like live a perfect life. Obviously, that's impossible. But just stuff I've been thinking about, like, how do you, like, what could I have done something different in childhood that would, program things differently, and not in a remorseful or regretful kind of way, but more just, proactively as a parent now, just trying to figure out, like, what can I do to set my kid up for success when he reaches this stage of life?
Yeah, because you will mess up, you know.
Of course,
A lot of it is
inevitable.
Dan Siegel. Have you heard of him? He's the guy
Yeah.
who like kind of okay, the really like invented the interpersonal neurobiology sort of movement with Kurt Thompson and other fellows like that.
Yes.
Really good stuff in there. And a lot of it is like you know, a coping mechanism is a means of like re-regulating, you know, like something is is disrupting our parasympathetic system, and we're trying to re-regulate. We're trying to catch our breath, our emotional wind. And so, like giving your kids, as you say, like coping mechanisms, help like healthy ways to re-regulate. And a lot of that's by example. You know, like I have
Right.
really vivid memories of my dad just blowing it, you know, and then later coming to me and getting on his knees and saying, "Hey, son, like that was really wrong of me. And I'm so sorry. I'm sorry." And
Wow.
he would say, "Will you forgive me?" You know, and it's just
Wow.
like, wow, like how it's like the agency he gave me and the dignity. That's just so crazy. And like I knew that like I had messed up too. Like it takes two to tango, but like I had messed up too. But he
Yeah.
was the one who was doing this first, and it would so convict and humble me.
That's
But
amazing.
it just did dignify my agency. So I think those sorts of things where it's like you don't try and pretend like you are perfect, but you show them how to like re-regulate, how to re-regulate
Yeah.
after you are compromised. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Dancing
good.
Gall would be a great place to start. I don't have any kids, so yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to take a look, man. Yeah.
Sathya, I really loved what you said earlier about counseling. That's one thing that I would want to maybe leave listeners with is be quick to go to counseling. Kaylee and I have been in counseling for like a year. Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Nice.
Be really quick to go to counseling. Do it's like don't leave it as your last option. You know, it's
Yeah.
not
Oh,
like a
yeah.
lot of people think of marriage as like you and your spouse against the world, you know? And it's like, no, like what if is it like the world for you and your spouse, or you and your spouse for the world?
Yeah.
So what is those sorts of paradigms look like? Be quick to go to counseling. It's not a sign of failure to sign that you are, it's a proactivity. It's like preventative health as opposed to reactive health. You know, like
Yeah.
what do you do to ensure that your marriage is staying healthy as opposed to trying to fix it when something breaks, you know? So I really
Yeah.
love like this is what you have with your wife, where you're at and the resolve that you have, because that's very similar to Kaylee and I, and that's been very important. So it's not an act of humiliation.
No, I totally agree. And I think the one thing, like to add another dimension to it is, evaluate, like, do you guys need to do counseling individually? Do you need to do it as a couple? You need both? Like, Shaloma and I have done tons of counseling since we've been married, but it's all just been very individual. Like, she had a lot of stuff she wanted to work through, and I had some things I wanted to work through as well. I think we were just at a point now where it's like, you know what? We'll continue to work on ourselves as individuals, but now we really need to do this as a couple, and focus a bit more on the marriage. So, I think having that discernment's really helpful. And one other thing I would leave listeners with is, these kinds of conversations are really valuable. And I wish I would have opened up to my friends earlier in marriage about the challenges, because I think especially early on in that year, like, you kind of have this unofficial pressure or expectation that, like, marriage is supposed to be bliss for the first little bit. And so when you're having challenges, you kind of wonder, like, oh, what's wrong? And I know for me, I had this, I was talking about how, like, I'm an Enneagram 3, and one thing that's really hard for us is to confess weakness, or to be seen that way. And so I know that for me was a huge point of pride. It was like, oh, I would love to talk to some friends and see if they went through this, but I also don't want to show that we're struggling. I don't want them to think I'm a bad husband, all that kind of stuff. And so I think, that's something I'm learning to do, definitely, especially as a parent now. And it's like, you know what, like, my it feels like my pride's just been crushed to a little pulp. Like, I need to ask for help, and I need to be transparent about where we're having challenges, because without that reassurance, or without even just honest conversations, it can feel really lonely, and you also end up struggling a lot longer with the issues. So, reach out to people and have more candid conversations. It goes a long way.
Amen, Sophia. I totally on board with all of that. It's been really great to process this with you.
Yeah.
I hope it's been helpful for listeners. I imagine it has been, but it's definitely been good for me. So thank you for just the solidarity and the camaraderie.
Yeah, likewise, man. Always appreciate our chats, and I'm already looking forward to the next one.
For sure.